Usually when we talk about like a ticking clock in a story, there's this expectation of consistency. A second is a second. An hour is an hour.
Right, yeah, it creates a quantifiable pressure.
Exactly. The sand falls through the hourglass at the same predictable rate, so you can plan your next tactical move accordingly.
You can basically budget your time. You know exactly how many resources you can expend before you have to rush to defuse the bomb or catch the train.
Right, but then you step into the Feywild, and suddenly that hourglass is full of like erratic glowing bees instead of sand.
That is a terrifying image, but very accurate.
Right. I mean, we are looking at a chronological landscape that is entirely untethered from reality. We are pulling from the comprehensive archivist data of session 31 of the Shattered Weave today.
A fantastic session.
Oh, absolutely. And our mission for this deep dive is strictly focused on you, the player sitting right there at the table. We want to decode the exact moment you lost control of reality.
Because the Feywild doesn't just attack your hit points first.
No, not at all.
It attacks your sanity, your decision-making, and, well, your understanding of consequences. By making time ambiguous, it forces you to make terrible tactical choices out of pure paranoia.
Which perfectly frames the opening of this session, I think. Okay, let's unpack this. You aren't just a group of adventurers wandering the woods.
No, you're carrying the psychological weight of an entire realm on your shoulders.
Right. When Illoan or Kaldra stop to bandage a wound, they aren't just thinking about their immediate survival. It's like playing a timed video game where your safe room also arbitrarily advances the doomsday clock.
Oh, that's exactly it. Every time you rest, people back home are in danger. They're picturing the Pact of the Lich moving on the Eye of Death.
Yeah, and they're imagining those highly suspicious Belguard contracts being signed back in Skirdland.
Yeah.
The clock ticks at home while you take a breather here.
And that overarching pressure is the exact lens through which we have to view the first major decision in the Dryad's Grove. This sanctuary, the party dub New Grove.
They are beaten up at this point, right?
Oh, heavily. Mechanically, they desperately need a long rest, but they fall into this intense tactical debate and they end up choosing a short rest instead.
Wait, really? They intentionally chose exhaustion.
Yeah, they chose exhaustion over the risk of time dilation. It's a brilliant example of narrative stakes completely overriding optimal gameplay mechanics.
Wow.
Taking a short rest means rolling a few hit dice and pushing on with depleted spell slots and abilities. But they do it because the fear of what a full night's sleep in the Feywild might cost their allies back home is just paralyzing.
They are trading their own physical well-being for the hope of preserving Skirdland's timeline. That is such a heavy burden for the players.
It is, but before they leave this sanctuary, the unnamed Dryad.
Oh, the one the party affectionately dubbed Booby Lady.
Yes, that one.
I love that, by the way. It shows the table is still finding humor in all this stress.
It really does. So she gives them a critical piece of parting wisdom. She tells them that fey bargains matter deeply,
Right.
and that anyone who offers hospitality considers their guests safe from harm.
She is essentially handing them the golden rule of fey economics there.
Exactly. This isn't flavor text, it's a survival mechanic. In a realm where physics and time are completely broken, the only true laws are hospitality, debt, and bargains.
She also provides the physical roadmap, right? Follow the trail to the Orchard of Excess, pass through it, find a river, and the Archfey is waiting on the other side.
Which is the ultimate goal here. The Archfey is the only known ticket back to Skirdland.
So the party thanks her and steps out of the grove. And I have to say, the archivist data describing this departure is incredibly visceral.
It's striking.
The light doesn't fade into a gentle twilight, it flicks off.
Like a switch.
Yes, it is a literal switch being flipped from dusk directly to starlight. Lyriel and Elowen both look up, and the moon is impossibly massive. It's casting these elongated, totally alien shadows across the undergrowth.
This is an immediate aggressive disruption of their circadian rhythm. The environment itself is establishing that they do not belong here.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though. This isn't just spooky ambiance, right? The Feywild feels palpably wrong.
Right.
It's like a theater set where the lighting director just smashed the controls. It's actively hostile to our hero's sense of reality.
I completely agree. The flora, the lighting, the shadows, they are all calibrated to disorient mortals. It is psychological warfare setting the stage for physical warfare.
And that hostile atmosphere immediately materializes into a threat. They hear a low growl from a clearing ahead.
Alistair suspects wolves, right? He urges caution.
Yeah, so Lyriel slips into stealth. She scouts ahead by a large stone outcrop, and she comes face to face with a wolf. but the hide of this creature is studded with thick, vicious thorns.
Ugh, horrifying.
It bares its teeth, and instantly, more wolves answer from the brush. The pack has already closed in. The ambush is sprung.
Let's break down this combat, because analyzing the stat blocks and armor classes completely misses the narrative brilliance of what happened at the table here.
Absolutely. It was so character-driven.
Exactly. This encounter was defined by deep character vulnerability and the mechanics of trauma. Let's look at Alistair first.
Okay, yeah. The archivists note that Alistair has severe established trauma regarding wolves because, well, he literally died to them previously.
Right. So when this pack attacks, he freezes. We talk about the frightened condition in tabletop mechanics, you know, where you roll with disadvantage and can't move closer to the source of your fear.
Yeah, the standard debuff.
But Alistair's player elevates this way beyond a mechanical debuff. He role-plays a complete psychological lockdown.
He uses humor as a defense mechanism. He throws out this nervous quip from the absolute backline. He says something like, I must say I quite like these mystery roles.
Yeah, while casting Shield of Faith on Lyriel.
Right. He is paralyzed by the memory of his own death. He uses a support spell specifically because he cannot bring himself to engage offensively.
It's a perfect synthesis of role-play and mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But contrast that paralysis with Kaldrath's strategy on the front line.
Oh, Kaldrath is wild here.
He doesn't hesitate for a second. He steps right up, hurls a javelin, plants his feet squarely in front of Lyriel, and shouts a challenge to the pack.
And he pays a brutal price for taking that aggro. A wolf bites him and knocks him completely off his feet.
He really does. He is functioning as the ultimate anchor in a chaotic environment. He gets right back up, wounds another wolf, and then the pack coordinates his brutal assault.
Yeah, multiple bites.
And Kaldrath is knocked down again. He is letting himself get mauled because every hit he takes is a hit that doesn't land on his traumatized cleric or his rogue.
He is just absorbing the chaos, which, I mean, perfectly enables this lethal, wordless coordination between Kondo and Lyriel.
Well, the action economy of what Kondo does here is amazing. We have to look at it. Kondo is a dual-wielding former Iron Fang mercenary.
Right, so you'd think he'd just rush in.
Exactly. The instinct for any melee fighter is to close the distance and attack immediately. Instead, Kondo holds his action. He exercises veteran discipline, willingly giving up his initiative advantage to manipulate the battlefield, basically waiting for the enemy to overextend.
It's a brilliant tactical delay, and Lyriel capitalizes on it instantly. She charges past the battered Kaldrath, drives her short sword in for a kill, and vanishes into the bushes using her hit-and-run mobility.
Playing the rogue class flawlessly.
Flawlessly. And the moment the wolves shift to track her, Kondo unleashes his held action. Just a blinding flurry of katana and wakizashi strikes. He counterattacks the exact wolf Kaldrath had weakened with his javelin.
It's so cinematic. But amidst this high-level tactical execution, the Feywild's chaotic magic rears its head through Eloan.
Oh, the frost spell.
Yes. She attempts to cast a frost spell early in the fight, but the ambient magic of the realm seems to, like, resist her structured incantation.
The spell misfires dramatically, and she hilariously freezes a random tree branch instead.
And then she tries to scramble up some rocks for high ground and fails that, too.
Mm. I love that frozen tree branch. I really do. It grounds the scene. When the dice fail, it isn't just a miss, you know? It reflects a reality that refuses to cooperate.
It adds a much-needed moment of levity to an incredibly tense situation.
Yeah, and she does recover later, hitting a mauling wolf with Ray of Frost to slow it down. But the turning point of the battle really pivots back to Alistair and Kaldrath.
Alistair realizes that staying in the back line isn't sustainable. He forces himself to push through that psychological barrier.
That must have been a huge moment at the table.
It was. He casts Sacred Flame, burning one of the beasts, and summons a spiritual hammer that violently slams into the same wolf.
And simultaneously, Kaldrath, who has been knocked flat into the dirt twice now, invokes the divine power of Igna. He slays the wolf standing over him and takes a breath mid-combat to earnestly thank Lyriel for covering his blind spots.
That mid-combat thank you is everything. Even while bleeding out, the bonds of the party are prioritized over the mechanics of the fight.
Kondo pushes beyond his limits, closes the gap, and finishes the last thorn wolf with his blades. The battle ends. But man, the silence that follows is infinitely worse than the growling.
Because the immediate aftermath reveals that the wolves were merely a symptom of a much larger disease.
Yeah.
As the adrenaline fades, the party looks at the corpses.
Yeah.
The thick thorns are still growing out of the dead flesh.
It's such a visceral, horrific image. Brambles are rapidly sprouting and spreading. Roots are visibly pushing down into the leaf litter of the forest floor, literally anchoring the dead bodies to the earth.
Just gross.
The forest itself starts vibrating with a sick, unnatural energy. The ecosystem is being actively corrupted right in front of them.
You're right on cue. The sound of pan pipes drifts through the trees. It announces the arrival of the mysterious satyr we've seen briefly in previous sessions.
Right. He appears on a nearby rock.
He looks down at the spreading corruption and drops a massive warning. He says the infestation will spread uncontrollably unless the corpses are dug up and burned immediately.
Okay, wait. I'm hung up on this satyr. Yeah, so what does this all mean? We have this satyr who shows up just to give chores and watch. He delivers this urgent apocalyptic warning, but then he completely refuses to lift a single finger to help them.
He calls himself an observer.
Right. I don't buy that he's just lazy. Is he actively trying to get the party killed by forcing them to stay in a dangerous area? Or is he physically incapable of interfering because of some weird Feywild rule? It's his forest being corrupted.
It definitely feels malicious on the surface. But you have to view his inaction through the strict lens of the Fey economy we discussed earlier.
The hospitality and bargains thing.
Exactly. In the Feywild, to act is to alter a bargain or incur a debt. By remaining a strict observer, he maintains his neutrality and avoids cosmic liability.
So he's looking for a loophole.
Yes. He is outsourcing the labor of saving his own home to the mortals, because mortals aren't bound by the same arcane restrictions.
But his warning traps the party in a terrible dilemma. They are exhausted. They only took a short rest because they were terrified of losing time for Skirdland. Now they are being told they have to stay and perform heavy, disgusting manual labor to stop a magical plague.
And they step up and do it anyway. Mm. They accept the responsibility of being heroes in a world that isn't theirs.
The physical toll is immense, though.
Oh, yeah. Olowen struggles to tear a rooting corpse free from the earth. Kaldrath drags one, his wrists getting deeply scraped by the vicious thorns.
Kondo makes multiple trips, gathering hacked apart remains, his fingers getting pricked and bloodied.
And Lyriel tries to drag a massive corpse, fails, and Kondo has to step in to help her haul it onto the makeshift pyre.
Which brings us to the emotional climax of this entire sequence. They build the pyre. Lyriel produces flasks of oil to douse the bodies, but she doesn't light it.
No.
Kondo gently nudges Alistair to step forward.
Kondo's situational awareness here is astounding. Mm. He recognizes that Alistair didn't just fight physical wolves today.
I think he fought his trauma.
Exactly. He fought his deepest, most paralyzing trauma. Lighting the pyre isn't just a chore. It is necessary psychological closure.
Alistair forces himself to approach the massive pile of thorny dead wolves. I mean, the literal manifestation of his past death. He steps right up to the source of his terror, and he sets the oil ablaze.
The flames catch, and the unnatural thorn growth violently shrivels and dies in the fire.
The corruption is purged, and the satyr, he just politely applauds, turns around, and vanishes behind the rocks.
Typical Fey behavior. But the chore is complete, even if the cost was astronomical. The ambush combined with the grueling labor leaves the party entirely depleted.
Which forces a massive pivot. They cannot keep running on empty. They realize a harsh truth here. Dying from exhaustion in the middle of a Fey forest helps absolutely no one back in Skirdland.
Right. If they fail here, the Belguard wins anyway.
So they make the terrifying call to take a full night's rest.
Illoen steps up to secure the perimeter. She activates her protective amulet, raising a magical sheltering dome over the party.
A little safe haven.
Yeah, they hunker down inside this arcane bubble and finally get some real, desperately needed sleep.
And they wake up fully rested. They pack their gear, feeling physically recovered for the first time in days. And then they look at the sky.
The sky.
I think this is the most unnerving cosmic horror detail in the entire session data. The giant moon has not moved.
8 hours of sleep. Absolute physical recovery. And the sky remains completely static.
It's chilling.
The visual evidence of time passing simply does not exist.
It is deeply terrifying. Time is completely broken. They have no idea how much time has passed back home, or if time has even passed at all.
The paralysis of the unknown is heavy, but they can't dwell on it. They push forward, following the Dryad's trail, and finally arrive at their destination.
The Orchard of Excess.
The Orchard of Excess.
The archivist data paints an overwhelmingly intense picture of this place. Branches are literally snapping under the sheer weight of luminescent glowing fruit.
The visual contrast is wild.
You have fresh, vibrant blossoms existing on the exact same branch as rotting, spoiled produce. The air is thick, almost unbreathable, with the cloying smell of fermenting sweetness.
And the bees.
Oh my gosh, the bees. Massive, drowsy bees drift slowly among flowers that are large enough for a grown person to sleep inside.
It is the ultimate embodiment of Fey extremes. The juxtaposition of hyper-vibrant life and putrid decay side by side perfectly encapsulates the chaotic, unregulated nature of Fey magic.
It's like walking into a bakery where everything is free, but you know the baker is a serial killer.
That is a very specific, very accurate analogy.
The Orchard of Excess is like a deep-sea anglerfish. It uses a bioluminescent lure of infinite fermenting sugar to completely overload your senses, basically blinding you to the teeth waiting in the dark.
It is not just a creepy forest. It is an active, predatory ecosystem.
The abundance isn't a gift, it's a trap made of sugar. And our heroes wisely halt right at the entrance, staring down this impossible landscape, which is exactly where the session ends.
Leaving the players with a wonderfully tense cliffhanger.
True.
If we synthesize the board state going into session 32, there are three massive, unresolved hooks staring you down.
Let's lay them out for the listener.
First, the Thorn Infestation. What exactly is this corruption? The fact that a strictly neutral Fey like the Satyr showed urgency proves it's a recognized existential threat to the realm.
Is this unnatural sickness connected to the rift in the garden that brought you to the Feywild in the first place? Is it the rot spreading from your world to theirs or vice versa?
Cause and effect are entirely blurred.
They really are. Hook number two.
The Orchard of Excess itself. You are standing right at its gates. Everything we know about Fey lore tells us this predatory ecosystem is governed by bizarre hidden rules.
Yeah, how do you pass through a place of rotting, irresistible abundance without eating the fruit, falling asleep in a flower, or triggering some ancient, inescapable trap?
The Dryad told him to go through it, but she certainly didn't provide a survival manual.
Definitely not. And the third hook.
The ultimate goal. The Archfey. Waiting somewhere beyond the river, past this terrifying anglerfish of an orchard, is the Archfey.
The most unpredictable variable in this entire realm.
Exactly. And your only known ticket back to Skirdland. What staggering price will they demand in exchange for opening a bridge home?
It's going to be steep, whatever it is. But here's one final thing to consider before you sit back down at the table and roll those dice. Mm. You've just slept a full night under a moon that refused to move. The Feywild's timeless beauty is deceptive. You accepted the Dryad's hospitality in her grove. She offered you her sanctuary, her safety, and her directions.
Right.
And in Fey logic, a gift is never, ever free. You survived the Thorn Walls and you purged the corruption. But the real question isn't how many days or weeks have already slipped by in Skirdland. The real question is, what exactly do you now owe the Booby Lady? And when, in the middle of this hostile, broken reality, does she plan to collect?